I debated with myself before, in preparing for this, how much apology I would give you before starting. I forgot to think of... So here I am, I'm going to start in on the apology portion of the Dharma talk. I forgot to think, sometimes I burst into tears in the middle of giving Dharma talks. The first Dharma presentation that I was asked to give was as a novice at the Portland Buddhist Priory, where I had trained for many years, and... actually was one of the sort of founding members there. So I was asked to give a Dharma talk when River Master Meiko was doing her induction ceremony. And honestly, I just couldn't make it through the talk. I had something prepared, and I just couldn't go through. I couldn't make it through. I burst into tears. And so I hope that won't happen here. This is the first time that I've given a Dharma talk in the Buddha Hall at Shasta Abbey. So this is a significant thing for me. I'm getting better at just kind of going on, but... Okay, so the apology portion is done. What I wanted to talk about this morning is maybe best described by saying the relationship between keeping the precepts, practicing the precepts, and meditation. In our tradition of Soto Zen, we are given the precepts and taught to meditate. The Soto Zen tradition, of course, is a Zen tradition, so meditation is really right at the heart of everything that we do. It's right; it's the foundation of everything that we do. And the precepts are right close in there as well. So oftentimes we're talking about meditation of the precepts in various ways, various aspects of the Dharma come back to meditation and the precepts. Also, today we'll be talking a little bit about an idea which we sometimes refer to as cleansing karma. There's a principle of our tradition, which is that all beings have Buddha nature. All beings are Buddha nature, according to Dogen. And we have an intuition of this, and so we come to train. The question then arises, if I'm Buddha nature, this question arises for me, and maybe one that'd be useful for you to take a look at. If all beings are Buddha nature, if I'm Buddha nature, if I have Buddha nature, why don't I see it? Why don't I know it? And the simple answer to that is that, well, we have karmic obscurations. We have habits of mind which keep us from seeing Buddha nature. And so our objective in practice, most of our effort in practice, most of our effort in our religious life is coming to understand our own minds, seeing where we obscure Buddha nature, and trying to purify that, trying to cleanse that, trying to remove those obscurations. That is the kind of focus of our practice. That's where our practice really takes place, right there in our own minds. We're looking at our own minds. We're saying, what is it that's obscuring Buddha nature in my mind? Why don't I see it? And this is what I'm doing. I'm training myself to understand my own mind and to let go of those things which obscure Buddha nature. That is kind of training in a nutshell, if it can be put into a nutshell. Now, before I go much farther, there is an idea, again, kind of central to meditation, this idea of letting go of what arises in our minds. You know, when I teach someone how to meditate, I say, well, whatever arises in your mind, allow it to arise, be there for as long as it wants to be, and allow it to pass away. Do your best to not get in there and do anything with it. All too often, though, I think we have kind of submerged in our conditioned way of thinking that letting go, there's an element of pushing away in letting go. So when we let something go, we think, on some subtle level, that we're actually going to get rid of it. But that is not entirely correct. It may be that the thing that we're going to let go of is something that we quite like. And so when we approach the idea of letting it go, we're worried that we're going to have to get rid of it. And so then we're resistant to letting it go. It may be that when we actually let it go, it might actually stay there, but it might go quickly. That's a risk that we have to take. So when I think about letting go, I think about, as an example of letting go, I think about this chair. If I hold on to the chair while I'm sitting in it, it doesn't really make that much difference. You know, it doesn't really function. The chair functions fine. It doesn't really affect my relationship to the chair too much. But if I'm holding onto the chair and I decide to stand up and leave, or drop my mat, then it becomes problematic, as you can see. It's hard to get around in a crowded room, for instance. Oh, thank you, Reverend Inya. Sleeves. Thank you. Guess I'm supposed to do that. But if I'm not holding onto the chair, I can stand up and walk around and do what I need to do, independent of the chair. And I can, again, do what I need to do and come back and make use of the chair when I need to. And actually, if I'm not holding onto it while I'm sitting in it, it does make it more comfortable. So this is an idea I think that's quite important that we understand in meditation. We understand about letting go, that we're just not holding onto it. So I can make use of it. And think about that as I'm talking. I'm continuing to make use of the chair, even though I've let it go. I can make this closer now. Okay. I find it useful to reflect because as part of my own conditioned thinking, part of cleansing my own conditioned thinking, my own conditioned thinking comes out of the Judeo-Christian background, the Abrahamic traditions. My conditioned thinking is deeply conditioned by this. I don't have a complaint about that. It's just the way that it is, just the nature of my mind and life. So when I'm thinking about Buddhism, when I'm thinking about the Dharma, when I'm thinking about practice, I like to remind myself that Buddhism is quite different than the Abrahamic traditions. Okay, it's quite different than the Western intellectual tradition that we're all trained in. It's quite different. It's quite different in the sense that the way that we handle our discriminatory faculties is quite different. It's much different. We don't give our discriminatory faculties the ascendancy that it has in the West or in the Abrahamic traditions. So in other words, the significance of this is that there isn't the same relationship between us and what is right and what is wrong. Okay. So what is right and what is wrong in the Abrahamic traditions and Western intellectual tradition, there's an idea that because we have discrimination, there should be an ultimate right and there should be an ultimate wrong. And we can kind of talk about that and what that's all about, but I don't have time to do that today, so we'll just take that as it is. One of the main ways that we keep ourselves from seeing Buddha nature is by clinging to our discriminatory faculty. Okay, that is karma. That is our karmic habit. We cling to discriminatory thoughts. We cling to what we think is right and what we think is wrong. Okay? We cling to our ideal of what is right and what is wrong. And oftentimes we're clinging to those things in a very submerged way, in a way that we don't recognize. It's just part of our deep conditioning. So, as I say, I think to myself, Buddhism is very different. It's helping me to come to see that. It's helping me to come to see where I'm clinging to discriminatory thought. Okay. And so we need to think about the precepts in a different way than we think about traditional morality. We need to think about the precepts as a tool, as an expression of what life beyond discriminatory thinking is, what life beyond clinging to discriminatory thinking is. Okay. It's not another set of rules that we establish that we can use to establish what is right and what is wrong in the world. So we might think there's a precept that says don't kill. And we say because the Buddha taught don't kill, we think, oh, that means that killing is wrong and that not killing is right in an ultimate sense. Instead, what the Buddha said was, killing has consequences. Killing has consequences that, if we're not careful of, will lead us into grave suffering. If we don't kill, then potentially we can avoid grave suffering. Now, that's a very different thing than establishing that killing is right or wrong. Killing is wrong, sorry. And not killing is right. Okay. And we don't need to get into, I don't think we need to get into all the subtle things about that. So the precepts are not, again, are not another standard that we have to set up for our discriminatory mind to make use of. But the precepts are very useful because they give us a means to work on our minds to see how it is in our minds that we obscure Buddha nature, how it is in our minds that we obscure the deepest truth. Now, our particular practice of Soto Zen is, this is a very important idea in the particular practice, our particular practice of Soto Zen. Because, and it's important to all of us, because we start right in the beginning, we start with this practice. I mean, the first time you come to the temple, the first thing that the monks want you to do is learn how to meditate. Okay, and really what they're doing, really what you're doing when you learn how to meditate is you're giving expression to the Buddha nature, you're giving expression to the deepest wisdom of your own heart. We're given three things when we come to the temple. We're given meditation, the precepts, and the scripture of great wisdom. And you might think, when you start, I'll start and I'll learn how to meditate and I'll do work on these precepts, but when will I get to the good stuff? When will I get to what is really the truth? What's really fun? But we're actually given it all right in the beginning. This is a really amazing thing. The precepts, meditation, the scripture, great wisdom. Right from the beginning, right from the get-go, the first time you come in. And you don't realize it, but there it is. That's what you need for practice. It's pointing right at it, right there. So there's a famous teacher in our tradition, Daikon Enno, Huineng in Chinese. Right? Yeah, that's the right one. And in a way, he really established the way we think about Zen practice. And his story was he was an illiterate woodcutter. He gathered wood in China around the 1000, something like that, BCE. he went around just gathering wood, and one day he heard someone chanting, I think it was the Diamond Sutra, and he had an awakening to the truth, to the deepest wisdom of the heart. And so he thought, oh, well, that's pretty interesting, and went in search of how to kind of come to understand that and how to develop it, and ended up in a monastery pounding rice, working in the kitchen pounding rice. And there was a contest, it was really a contest, in the monastery to see who understood the Dharma the best, so that the abbot could pass on the tradition to that person. And so the abbot said, you know, Daimon, sorry, his name is, brain's not really working very well today, so. Daimon Konin says, okay, all you monks in the monastery, bring me a verse giving expression to your understanding. And whoever expresses it the best, I'll pass on the truth to you. So there was another monk in the community, Jinshu, who was pretty much the leader of the community and who everyone expected the Dharma would be passed on to. And so he said, okay, well, I'll write the verse. He had a great deal of difficulty actually presenting it to the teacher, to Daimon Konin. So he ends up writing the verse on the wall, because he's afraid to go in and present it to the teacher. This is a clue. So he writes his verse on the wall, and Daikan Eno comes by, and again, he's illiterate, and he gets someone to read the verse for him. And he thinks, well, you know, great, but that's not really quite it. And so he writes his own verse on the wall. And for the purpose of my talk, the two verses are giving expression to, in a sense, what we might call training in the precepts and training in meditation. Training in the precepts, training in meditation. So I'll read you the verses and we'll talk about that. So Jinshu's verse goes, our body is a Bodhi tree, our mind like a dressing stand with its clear mirror. Time upon time, let us strive to wipe it clean, and let not dust or dirt abide thereon. Okay, so what he's talking about is, okay, my body, mind, this is Buddha nature here, and I'm going to just keep on working at it, keep on working at those precepts, and I'm going to keep cleaning it, until I can see what's really true. Just going to keep working at it. Looking at my mind, keep seeing where am I breaking the precepts, what are the subtle ways in which I'm obscuring Buddha nature. I'm just going to keep working on that. And Daimon Konin says, well, that's pretty good. You know, if you do that, it's going to be pretty good, and you'll become a Buddha eventually. Okay. And then Eno, he has someone read the verse to him, and again, he says, I think I can do better than that. So he has the person who read the verse write up on the wall his own verse. And his own verse goes, Bodhi is truly not a tree, nor is the clear mirror a mirrored dressing stand. From the first, not a single thing exists. So from where is the dust or dirt to arise? Buddha nature exists. Buddha nature is. We do all kinds of things to make smoke and dust, to obscure this. But Buddha nature exists. It is only by just dropping things, just letting go, that we see that Buddha nature has always existed. This is a hard thing to do. This is a hard place to find. But it is the important matter in our tradition. It is the most important thing. And it is possible to hold on to the precepts in such a way as to obscure this. it is possible to insist on the keeping of the precepts in such a way that we obscure this. And in that sense, you need to be quite careful. And we need to, in a sense, let's see, I'm going to explain this. In a sense, we just need to continue to have faith that Buddha nature exists. If we don't see it, if we don't see it at the level that Daikon Enno is talking about, we need to continue to have faith that it exists. And more than that, we can have it in mind that some of us know this. And that is informing our behavior. So when I look at Reverend Master Hario, I think he knows this. And his behavior, while I don't claim that it's perfect, I look at it and think he's giving expression to this thing. And the way that he leads the order is giving expression to this thing. Because it is the most important principle of our tradition. Because of the way that the Western world works, it is quite possible for this principle to become obscured. This idea that Buddha nature simply is, and we need to simply drop what there is in order to see that. We need to drop our clinging to whatever expectation we have in order to see this. In a sense, this is quite profound because we can, we might think that it's only after many years of training in the precepts and becoming quite a perfect person that we will ever begin to see this. But that, in fact, is not true. I heard one teacher describe it as, you can be a real bozo and still awaken to the truth. I thought that was quite good. Another teacher actually said, we can realize the truth even with this dirty body that we have. Okay. And it is through the practice of Zazen that we come to know this thing. It is through the practice of just letting go that we know this thing. Now, again, we have our tradition. We have our Soto Zen tradition. There's a popular phrase these days, which I find interesting. People will often tell you, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. Okay? And fair enough. I understand that there's a lot that religion has to answer for, in a sense. For myself, I find that looking realistically at my own mind and my own propensity for self-delusion, that the tool of religion is quite useful, is quite helpful. And I guess you would say that I had kind of gone off the deep end with regard to religion. I sometimes think, you know, how did I get here? But here I am. And so I have devoted my life and time to studying what the religion teaches and how that relates to what is spiritual, how that relates to what is true, not just in the sense of what the religion claims to be true, but what is actually fundamentally true for human beings. Because Buddha nature exists for everybody. It's not something that is exclusive to those of us in this room or those of us practicing Zen. Buddha nature exists for everyone. So to me, the value of a religious tradition is to give me a means, a tool, a vehicle for penetrating deeply into the kind of confusing morass of my mind. And I try to think that I hope that I'm in charge of my practice. I hope that I am not simply, you know, kind of giving into the hierarchy institution of the thing, but actually trying to make use of my religious practice, the religious forms, to give expression to that deeper thing. And so, in that sense, what I'm trying to do in terms of my formal practice is what I'm cultivating. I'm cultivating a relationship, as I've described with regard to this chair. I'm letting go of it while I'm making use of it. And the precepts are the same. Reverend Master Jiyu said time and time again, and the Buddha gave expression to this time and time again, that we must always keep the precepts all the way to the end. There's a mistake that we can make where we hold on to the precepts too much and insist that everything be just so, just ultimately nice, you know, very moral. And that's a mistake. It can obscure Buddha nature. But we can also hold on to our I'm spiritual but not religious view of wisdom, of the kind of there is nothing from the first that Daikon Enno is giving expression to. And by holding on to that, we can cause great suffering for ourselves and others. Because we begin to think, oh, I need to let go of the precepts. And in letting go of the precepts, I'm pushing them away instead of making use of them, instead of continuing to train myself in them. So both things are very important. It is more, I suppose, common to hold on to the precepts than to hold on to wisdom. So we need to be able to look at that and see. But both things we can hold on to and make mistakes. So the practice of a tradition, the practice of a formal practice, again, helps me to put myself in a place where I'm most likely going to be able to let go of those things in a context where I'm not going to be confused by my own distortion. So we have the Sangha, we have the practice, we have the Dharma, which we can constantly refer back to and see, is my behavior in accord with the Dharma? Is my behavior in accord with the Sangha and how the Sangha practices? So these are kind of protections for me. And always there is bowing. These are my notes. I don't really want to talk about bowing yet, but I do want to find out whether I've covered everything I need. Okay. So again, we have our practice, our formal practice, the practice of Soto Zen. We're trying to talk about and teach about two things which, in a sense, can seem to be at odds, practicing the precepts and practicing a kind of radical acceptance that is wisdom, is Zazen. They only appear to be at odds when we begin to discriminate about them. Keizan has a nice thing. He says, within Zazen, there are no precepts that are not kept. That's how he says it. In other words, the more deeply we go into Zazen, the more there is a kind of inclination to keep the precepts. You need to be careful not to think, okay, so now I'm really practicing Zazen, so whatever I do is keeping the precepts. That would be a little squirrely, and so we don't want to go there. But there is an inclination that arises from a deep practice of meditation to keep the precepts. And so we continue to keep working on them. And this is given expression to in bowing. Bowing that we do formally in our ceremonies, but also just in daily life. Bowing is the expression of lift your hands up, which is letting go. It was an interesting thing I was thinking about recently, which is that in bowing, we are given, you know, when you bow to someone or bow to a situation, it's as if you are giving a power in a way. You're saying you're better than me in a sense. Or at least that's the kind of traditional Western view of bowing, or the worldly view of bowing. You know, we always bow to rulers. We're saying, okay, you know, you're the big guy, I'm the little guy. But, and in a way you can think of letting go as going along with that. But in a sense, I was thinking recently how letting go is really, this kind of letting go that we give expression to in our Buddhist bowing is really an expression of power. It's an expression of adequacy. It's an expression of Buddha nature. It's saying, okay, I can let go of my view of you, and I have the adequacy to stand here and be a full human being while letting go of my view of you, by letting go of my view of the situation. The Buddha said an interesting thing. He said, the world is neither as you think it is, nor is it different. And to me, I've been thinking that same kind of idea to myself a lot lately, or over the last couple number of years, and it's something I remind myself, okay, the situation is not really how you think it is. It's different than how you think it is. But I also want to include in there that it's not really different than how I think it is either. Because, you know, we can see what other people are doing, what other people are getting up to. So here we are, we're at the point where I talk about how we give expression to what I'm talking about. And so I'll have to give you some examples of this. And I'll apologize to anybody in the room who is involved in any of these stories. I truly do not hold a grudge or anything like that. But so one day I was in a ceremony, someone actually grabbed me by the front of my robe. Oops, sorry. Grabbed me by the front of the robe and shoved me out of the way. I was a novice. And I'm like, ooh, that was different. you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, this isn't really how you want to treat another monk. You know, this is not ideal. You could say it was not perceptual. And yet, there we are in this context of this ceremony. And I needed to, we weren't done with the ceremony yet, so I needed to kind of carry on and do my part. And they needed to carry on and do their part. And so the only thing that we could do is just let it go. Okay, well, that happened. We'll let that go and carry on and do the best that we could to give expression to meditation within the ceremony. And the person apologized afterwards. It's fine. Whatever. When I tell you that I just had to let it go, I'm not telling you that there was some kind of magical thing where I just let it go and then I felt all better and it was nice. Because for days afterwards, I'm thinking, what happened? You know, what was that all about? And I'm just continuing to let it go, okay? And when I reflect on it, I think to myself, this is not how I would want to treat someone else. Okay, that is one of the key lessons from the experience. But also, I can see how I could hold on to this experience and make it into some part of my mind that would always be unpleasant. Okay, does that make sense to you? I mean, I could hold on to that and be resentful. I could hold on to that and be, kind of afraid or all manner of things. So I'm kind of looking at that, and in the context of you know, living in a temple, as you all know, you kind of come to the temple and you kind of pretty much have to look at what's going on in your own mind. We don't really give you much opportunity to go somewhere else. I mean, that's kind of the function of it. So here I'm a novice, and that's my job. I'm looking at what's going on in my own mind. And so that's how I looked at it. I have to find a way, and I, you know, would work with that monk, you know, kind of on a more regular basis, and so I had to find a way to just let that go. And again, they sincerely apologized. It wasn't like this was, you know, they were trying to be great and teach me something or something like that. They just said, "I'm sorry, that wasn't very good." But still, there's this process of just letting it go, okay? So I'll take a little tangent here. One of the precepts, the 10th precept, do not defame the three treasures, is a very important precept. And when it was first explained to me, I think the person that explained it didn't really understand what was talked about there, because they said, "Oh, this is sort of a catch-all precept, and kind of takes care of everything." But I think reflecting on that person's particular training in life, I think, no, they didn't really understand this. To not defame the three treasures is to be sure that we're not blaming the three treasures for our suffering. Okay? And we're not blaming the three treasures for our suffering. We're not saying, because of the three treasures, I am suffering. So if I'm to look at that precept in regard to this story that I'm telling you, there's a way in which, you know, I could probably poll 1 million people and say, you know, what do you think? Was this wrong? Was this what this person did? Was this wrong? And about 1 million out of 1 million people would say, yeah, I think that's pretty wrong. Although maybe it would be 750,000 out of 1 million, because, you know, how it is with people. Nevertheless, it really didn't matter. Because what the Buddha taught was that if you're suffering, you're suffering because of your own mind. Or maybe in a more positive way of putting it, if you're suffering, you can let go of suffering within your own mind. You have the power to let go of suffering in your own mind. And by training, by engaging in the practice, that's the power that we have. So even had I kind of taken that person to court and gotten some judgment, I'm sure I still would have had those kind of things going on in my mind where I was suffering. So I just decided to bypass the taking it to court, bypass the blaming, and just look at my own mind and say, okay, well, why am I suffering here? What can I do about it in my own mind? And the bottom line was, well, I just have to let this go. I can learn what I can from it. I don't want to be like this. I'm going to go forward and do my best not to be like this. But I'm going to let this go. And this is how I have elected to train myself in this kind of situation. And it has taught me a great deal, because what it has enabled me to do is let go of my discriminatory mind. My relationship to my discriminatory mind is, again, just like the chair. It's still there. It's still functioning. It's still going. Yeah, the other day I was sitting in the precept ceremony and I was watching. I have a kind of active eyes, so I'm kind of looking around a lot. And I was watching another monk twiddling their thumbs while the precepts were getting read. They were doing it really small circles. But I'm seeing this, I'm thinking, oh, that's interesting. Not to be done by me. But I can see my own mind thinking, oh, that person's not really paying attention. Oh, they're not really doing that. Oh, there it is. That's a kind of suffering for me. Let that go. Let that go. Let that go. Because there's really no reason for me to hold on to it. There's really no function in holding on to it. There's nothing I can do about it. It's not my place to kind of teach that person, you know. And maybe they were just trying to keep themselves awake because they were really tired from some hard thing that happened to them. I don't know the situation. My point, though, is, again, my training, where I can find Buddha nature, where I can find release from suffering is in my own mind. It's in my own heart. It's because of my own practice of the precepts. It's because of my own practice of meditation. And this is where liberation comes. This is where unconditional liberation of mind is found. Right here, in this body, in this mind. I pray that I will be a good person and that at the end of my life, people will think that there is a loss rather than a gain at my departure. I know from looking at myself. Oh, I remember when I was head novice, like within 2 days, someone was thanking me profusely for how kind I was, and then someone else was calling me a fascist. So I figure, I have a lot to train with regard to myself. You know, there's many things that I need to convert and work on. I'm not trying to say that. And I apologize if I caused harm to anyone. I can imagine that someone else will be sitting in this place telling a story about me similar to the one of the, you know, that I'm telling you about in the ceremony. And I regret that. I hope that they will be able to make use of it in this way, where, okay, what is really important? What is really going on in my own mind? What is really happening here? How can I train myself? How can I put the Dharma into practice and train my own mind? How can I find unconditional liberation of mind? And so this is what we are trying to teach. This is what we're trying to preserve. This is what we're trying to pass on in Soto Zen. There is nothing from the first. Buddha nature exists. We, each one of us, each one of you, regardless of what your shape, size, color, whatever is, can find unconditional liberation of mind. It is in you. That is what we're trying to pass on. That is what we're trying to teach. Buddha nature exists. So, thank you.